followed offhand, so. So in summary, 2016, if somebody thinks this is feasible, show us an example. Line 17, why one of our analogy? So let's, translation is hard, is my assertion, no one's shown otherwise. There are, I think, many possible upper ontologies. We've got at least three formal ones that are certainly good in my mind, but there are infinitely many bad ones, and so taking one that's reasonable is important, and as an analogy, I admit this won't work for everyone, but we have lots of different human languages, and it's really hard to learn a new human language, but it's so much harder to carry a translator with you on your back to translate those foreign languages that people take this inordinate amount of time to learn if, in fact, they're going to be communicating on a daily basis with speakers of the target language. Slide 18, just more example of why formal definition is necessary. So here's UDEF to pick on these folks. It's a sort of, they call it a semantic naming standard. It's actually getting a lot of use, and this is very distressing to me, because if you look at these little pairs of definitions, process versus events, or code versus identifier, this is the entirety of the standard. There is nothing else other than what I keep getting told from these guys. Oh, go ask Ron Schultz, he'll tell you.
1 minute, Adam.
That's not a standard. A standard actually has all the definitions within it. It doesn't require recourse to a human oracle. And looking at these definitions, I have no idea what the difference is between a process and what should go in subclasses of each thing. And maybe even more shocking is the difference between code and identifier. I've actually asked Ron Schultz and other experts, and I still don't know what the difference between code and identifier is. So it's simply not enough to have this sort of lightweight definition. And I guess I would also say that it's not enough to have this definition somewhere. It has to be available in a specific single file that one can examine all in one place, all with a formal definition. Slide 19, and here I'm almost at the end, I've got 1 minute left. Isn't this stuff too
late? About 30 seconds.
A comment that I think is often made. I don't have a PhD in philosophy. I don't have experience in logic. How can I possibly understand this stuff? Why don't I just use this lightweight semantic web stuff? And my response is, there's an old joke about looking under the lamppost because, I may have lost my keys in the alley, but the light is better under the lamppost, so that's where I'm looking for the things that I lost. Well, years ago, there were people selling fourth-generation languages and saying, oh, this programming stuff is just too hard. You can't expect that we're going to have millions and millions of programmers. We'll just give you this wonderful little language and you do some visual modeling and without coming to program. And now we know that's simply not true. It doesn't work. Doing formal ontology, in my experience, and I think the experience of some others here, is a lot more like programming than it is like, doing a little taxonomy. Work in formal ontology is done primarily, in a text editor, like programming. It's done by people that actually have some training in the area. We shouldn't expect our sort of consulting clients to just be building this stuff on their own. They might do something, it may look nifty, it may feel good, but it's not actually semantic modeling.
Adam, we have to move on.
So I still by my clock has.
Okay, Adam, you're done. Thank you.
So forgive me, I thought I still had.
We have a hard stop here, Adam. Let's get.
Yeah, it's 9:33. We need to move on. Well, you'll have a chance to speak again. Barry Smith?
Yes, I'm in.
Okay, go ahead, Barry.
I'll wait until my slides start to appear. Let me just say one or two things about what Adam was saying. I agree with him wholeheartedly that it's hard to do mapping, and that the sorts of lightweight definitions that people like to fancy about are really not very useful to solve the sorts of problems that we're dealing with. I disagree with him about his final point.
Okay, your slides are up.
The problem which is implied by the idea that our ontology is more like programming than it is like doing taxonomy is that we need users, and that will be my principal message. So next slide. But Maslow, which is the ontology I've been developing for some years, most recently primarily with colleagues in the biomedical domain, is a very small, highest common denominator upper ontology. So it's smaller than the other upper ontologies. It exists in various formats, and it's being used primarily for people in biomedical science for supporting data management and supporting improvement in the lightweight terminologies that they use. Next slide. And we've been talking about the virtue of semantic interoperability. I'm assuming that it's this use and reuse of data across disciplinary boundaries or across company boundaries or ministry boundaries or educational boundaries that we're all interested in, that we all think upper ontology can help with. So upper ontologies allow communities to reuse the same data, the same software, even when they are coming at the data from different directions or at different times. So what we're trying to achieve with upper ontology is some sort of constraint on the degree to which people invent new formats for expressing their data, on new software for manipulating it. Next slide. And in this connection, we talk about semantic interoperability, but we don't always mean the same thing. So I'm assuming that most of the people present at this virtual meeting need some sort of genuine model theoretic semantics in the strictly logical sense. But I think most of the people who use the word semantic interoperability, and that's certainly true of most of the people in biomedicine who use ontology, need something much weaker than that. So they mean something like taking account of more than just syntax. Now, I think actually that there is something more that semantics has to mean. It's good to have a beautiful model theoretic semantic, but it's even better if you have an account of how your ontology or your terminology relates to the entities in reality that you're worrying about. The theoretic semantics is always guaranteed that. Next slide. So, Adam gave some examples of embarrassing lightweight ontologies. I'm afraid that the medical world and the biological world is still not up to speed on what the minimal requirements are. For instance, formulating good definitions. So you have definitions in the gene ontology, for instance, which is the most successful of all the ontologies, probably. Like this, hemolysis is defined as causes of hemolysis. Now, ontologies are used by thousands of institutions across the world, and there are other ontologies increasingly being defined in terms of the gene ontology. I'm engaged with the curator of the gene ontology in a very thorough reform process. We're trying to fix the gene ontology and to educate the people who curate it and use it. And the reason why it needs to be fixed in such a way that it can gradually approximate to something which Adam is inspired by. This may take a long, long time. Gene ontology contains something like 100,000 terms. There are some medical ontologies which contain more than a million terms. These ontologies are not in good formal shape. They are conveyed in a variety of different formats, but not always in formats which we would recognize as being logically coherent. And my goal is to demonstrate that upper ontologies which are formally coherent can help to improve matters in this regard. Next slide. So, my idea is to catch, for instance, groups of biologists developing a new ontology for physiology, let's say, or immunology, at an early stage before they build bad oncology. And to enforce them to use a good upper oncology, which is formally coherent, has formal definition, is axiomatized, allows the definition of a coherent formal semantics in the proper model theoretic sense, in such a way that whatever they do, it will at least have the reasoning power that the upper oncology that they are doing is in terms of. So formal rigor can be imported from the top. Next slide. My main message here is that unless we do this, unless we get domain oncology to be built in terms of an upper oncology, then we will end up with upper oncology, which are perhaps very useful artifacts, but they are like telephone switchboards without telephone subscribers. They are useful at best. So, upper ontologies require users, and if we agree that we need axioms and formal definitions, which are logically coherent in formalized, then we also need humanly equivalent axioms and definitions, which the actual users and constructors of domain ontologies will understand and find reasonable. So, everything we do on the formal side, we need to do in the realm of upper ontology, we need to do also in natural language. And we need to have an educational program which will overcome the feeling that all of this is too hard in such a way that the equivalent natural language axioms and definitions will in fact be used. And therefore I conclude from this that an upper ontology has to be something like common sense, the common sense shared by the main sciences or by the other group for which the upper ontology has been developed. Next slide. So, the method, the primary method which ontologists in biology use today is to annotate experiments. Experiments, clinical trials yield huge amounts of data. This data needs to be searched and reasoned with, and ontologists this data. If the ontologies are bad, if they're formally incoherent, then the tagging of the data may be good for certain kinds of statistical search methods. They're not going to be able to allow advanced reasoning and hypothesis checking. Next slide. So, we've been talking about the need for a register of upper ontologies. The National Center for Biomedical Oncology is building such a registry, and it has quite a lot of software expertise and money to support it. This will include also some upper oncologies. It will include all sorts of nice visualization and integration tools. I am sure that this particular project will support the kind of the registry idea that has been talked about in this context. But I think given what I've been saying so far, a registry needs to contain evaluation information, which includes information about the actual usage of the ontology. An upper ontology has to be used. And I think it was Chris Menzel who pointed out that it's really only a very small sublattice of upper ontology, which is actually being used for real integration efforts. And then my conclusion is that this summit might contribute to great semantic interoperability in ways that will actually bring benefit if it can show how to reason across these upper ontologies which are actually used. Because then we can reason across larger bodies of data annotated in the terms of these ontologies roughly along the lines that I've just described.
Thanks, Barry. You actually got us back on time. John Bateman's on the phone?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay.
Pulling his slides up.
Okay.
One second.
So I'll get started while the flights are coming up.
Right.
I'm going to tell you something about the background of the approaches to what colleges that we are thinking and presenting for Avon, and some of the conclusions that has led us to in terms of the necessary relations between our colleges and how to go about doing that. You'll see when we get through the slide here. Okay. So we're looking at the area of spatial reasoning, action, and interaction. And on slide two, we got a collection of programs of maybe on.
Hang on, just one moment.
We make
one
the,
second.
Please hold, please.
One second.
So you'll see when this is getting bigger that we are looking at a variety of. If you're all seeing the same that I'm seeing, then I won't say anything until the slide comes back. Oh, you can see it's PowerPoint.
Slide two.
Okay. So jump ahead to slide two, right? There we go. So we've got looking at spatial assistance systems, which involve interacting with a whole range of different kinds of information. As we see on slide three, and this goes back a little bit to Bennett's point, that if we have comparatively simple kind of questions, we're already combining a whole range of different kinds of information. But here we have one of the kind of robust situations we have, not the person in it that we're sitting on, but also a whole bunch of different robots. And we see from this, if we go to slide four, that we have the necessity of getting a high degree of interoperability between very diverse knowledge-rich systems. We got knowledge of the human world, we got the robot world, we got geo-knowledge, various kinds of spatial knowledge. And on slide five, this leads us to the fundamental issue for us, is that these opportunities are very diverse. They have different methodologies, different motivations, different domain applications. And this leads us really to where we started from about 4 years ago with this project on slide six, which is that we do not see that there's any sense here in which a simple merging of the ontologies involved is a sensible strategy to follow. So we don't try and put these all together in one. We go to what we see on slide seven, which is where we accept that there are many perspectives of reality, something which Brian has told us many times, and the world is either ontologically diverse. So our main goal is then shown on slide 8, where we believe that we will need to be specifying these different ontology areas in a fully academic fashion, and we'll be working on the inter-ontology mappings primarily. So the essential areas we're working on are then shown on slide 9, where we accept that we are going to have a radical perspectivalism. We're going to need to be dealing with object activities, we're particularly looking at spatial artifacts, and we're looking at natural language. In all of this, we also believe in graphical partitions, very much the focusing on the right way of decomposing the world as we're looking at it, and we are focusing on plug-and-play spatial theories. So, very much in here, we have the notion of interoperability relates between ontologies going all the way through. How we're doing this is shown on, or the basis for this is shown on slide 10, where we are working at present primarily with Dolce for a very rich binding across categories. We look at some of the typical taxonomy going top to bottom. We're very interested more in the horizontal relationships and the axiomatization. We're looking at morphology, and we're also looking very much at language, which is the last, the only one where I will take the custodian thereof, and that is the generalized upper model that we use for our linguistic work. I'll say something about that at the end. The formal ingredients that we are drawing on are shown on slide 11, where we are formulating our ontologies in the language Cosmos, Common Algebraic Specification Language. We are using this within a toolset, the heterogeneous toolset, and I'll say something a little bit more about as well, but that's where the real interaction and interoperability that we're discussing comes in. And we've got various sub-languages in Cosmos. Cosmos is described a little bit on slide 12. You see here that it's you coming from a rather different area, software development, and there are extensive documentation about it now available. 13, you can see the basic constructs that we use there. I won't particularly go into these and give you a flavor of what kind of constructions are available in the language. We see an example on page 14, or slide 14, where I took as an example one of the things we've had a discussion on this past week or so from the process specification here, where you see a on the right-hand side of the red box, a constant specification. And most importantly for now, is this information more on the left-hand side, where we see that there's an explicit representation of the reuse of a particular area of an ontology of the theory of law, the detectable partial order there. So this is explicitly representing. In slide 15, then we just have an overview of the different kinds of variations of the constant specification language we have going to different kinds of logic, which allows us to relate to different kinds of theorem rulers and in order to use various different kinds of techniques. And particularly for ontology, which we go on to slide 16, I want to give a brief example and then relate to the points of we see here part of work in progress where we are defining Dolce in cooperation with Nicola Guarino and others there, where we are putting a path and specification Dolce together. On the left hand side, you see again the path and theory which are being related. So here we have part. On slide 17, we see this growing a little bit. We see that we have generic neurology underneath the cardboard. And then on slide 18, then we see how these things are getting put together. We'll be combining parts of the primitive pathology and neurology in the time. What's important for us here now is not that we are particularly using Castle, it's as a language, more in terms of the structuring devices which are then available through the heterogeneous tool set that we use. So the idea here is that we would be able to work across different languages, not just Castle, for example, also common logic areas. And yesterday we in fact translated Sumo also into the Cosmos form, so we could import it into the system that we use. The people doing the conversion are a little bit over enthusiastic and took all the middle level 1 and 2, which gave us only 50,000 lines of Cosmos, but we haven't yet proved anything with it, but we have not anything. So we see on slide 19, then we see more of what there can be done when we have access to the materials here. We have here an example of the development graph, which was part of the heterogeneous toolset, where the lines between the various theories, the theories are movable there, denote particular theory modules. And we can see here imports between theories and complete interpretations of theories. And I'd like to relate this very explicitly back to what Adam Keith was drawing attention to, is that when you pull any of these axioms out of ontology, then lots of other stuff comes with it. And what we see in these kind of diagrams is exactly what comes with it. So the idea here is that we can approach this hard problem, provide tools for approaching the hard problem, and considering this hard problem as a problem which is not only doable, but also very valuable, is that it will allow us to get inside monolithic ontologies without pulling them apart in terms of particular theories which they construct it out of. We see this on slide 20, where we have the current version of the leaf sheet with Dolce puzzle, where you can see the final definition is a construction of various areas, various sub-series of the entire Dolce ontology, for example, classification of series dependence. So one suggestion we would make is that this would be a very appropriate level of granularity for having a registry of, but not registry just of operatologies, monolithic constructs, to really pull these apart and have definitions of theories which we can then consider alternatives and bring together and relate together in ways which may allow us much more deeper insight into the different manner of definitions which we see in the different ontologies. So, on to slide 21, towards the end. Okay. So we believe that the ontologies should be built out of they should exercise ontologies of course, but these should be grouped into logically appropriate theories. The theories may be extended in various ways, and they may be related when we have this ability to work with meaningful interrelationships in theory, do you think we really have a firm grasp upon how to relate different ontologies and different theories within ontologies? Because, of course, at the other extreme, we're having this kind of term by term kind of relationship that I would feel interesting. So we'd certainly like to take part of that task which he mentioned as something which should be easy if we believe in mapping. Certainly don't think it would be easy, but I certainly believe it would be very, very rewarding to do it. And I think we've got some of the tools to make that support that kind of task. So the other area, just to round up on slide 22, just to mention as we go through, the other area which I'm bringing here is the generalized upper model which we use for our linguistic work. This is the same kind of methodology that we've seen coming from the Penman upper model where it's derived from. And in effect, it acts as an insulation. We wrap it around our real ontologies, if you like, to make sure that not too much stuff which is specific to language ends up polluting our ontologies. So the idea is to absorb the things which are coming from language and then only let through the things which are really the distinctions which are appropriate for ontologies. And that's an area where I think we might also have something to say about topics of common subject, because this kind of representation is very simple, because it's based on language, so it has a certain place to be readily intelligible.
John, we have 5 minutes.
Right,
John, 5 minutes left.
5 minutes, great, wow, what's up? As you see on slide 23, there we have some comments about the generalized upper model where it relates to natural language components. Because of this link to natural language, we see it relatively straightforward. And one of the problems which we had previously from its taking to the Penman upper model was this very under-axiomatized. We're now going through and relating this explicitly with a higher degree of axiomatization to Dolce via the description of the situation of quality space provided in Dolce. Very important says doesn't mean that it becomes merged with Dolce, but this is an interesting difference to, for example, how the Penman upper model was absorbed or merged with Sight. What we're doing here is to say that these are very different purposes, and therefore we need to have this interoperability inter-ontology mapping rather than a merging, because they're doing different kinds of work. So that's an interesting area, I think, where we might relate to this question of the physical common subject. So finally, on slide 24, and after that, we see a summary of the work in progress, where we are working on particularly comprehensive formalizations of spatial calculi. So this is an idea where we have different ontologies of space. Again, it's very crucial to say that, well, we do not believe that relating all of this just back to geometry would not be the kind of solution which we require, because we need to relate to how people are using these systems of organizing space, and people tend to adopt qualitative calculi rather than linear geometry. They are working on formal integration of ontologies as well, by building a theory that checking consistency of integration of ontologies, and all of this is running within the heterogeneous toolset where we are working content development, interrelation of the ontologies which I mentioned so far, Dolce, Fargo, and our linguistic ontology. Finally, on slide 25, we can see how we consider this to be making our lives easier. So we are simplifying the ontology diagram, or simplifying the users, where we want to ensure that each component of a library of theories only specifies the axioms which are relevant at that point. We're going to comment about this from and this is exactly the kind of modularization that we see at a very fine level of detail in, for example, our Dolce form reformulation organization in Carter. That reformulation and working out the modules of the ontology
John. We have to move on.
We have to move on. Thank you.
Yep, we're done.
Thanks.
The next up is Michael Gruninger.
Yep. I actually have the thingy.
The
thingy. Yeah. It's only a handful of things.
So it doesn't have a soul.
Yeah.
So, what is our...
We have 15 minutes for Michael, and then a 15-minute discussion period. And then we break.
The plenary begins promptly at 10:30.
Okay, which building?
The big tall building, main auditorium.
Okay, so what we need is, will that take about 5 minutes?
Yeah, so I'm going to be going over there early. That introduces the director then, so...
Okay, so we'll probably have just a few minutes of discussion, and then we'll have to go to the next building.
I'd say 10:20.
What's the title of that?
The plenary is, well, the director is introducing the whole interoperability week, and then there'll be two speakers from Capitol Hill, staffers from the Health Science Committee, and the Vice President of Standard Strategy from IBM.
And then we'll meet back here at 1?
Yes.
Okay, and we'll meet back here at 1 o'clock after the plenary session.
And there was lunch provided in the cafeteria at the far end. We'll guide each other.
Okay. Okay, Mike?
Okay. So I just want to begin with, you know, one of the goals for this meeting was to develop some methods for relating the existing upper ontologies to each other, and I don't want to just focus on that. Talk about some of those methods. And it's not just for relating upper ontologies to each other, but it's also, if you have an ontology that's reusing an upper-level ontology, what are those relationships between those two? If you have two ontologies that are sharing the same upper-level ontology, what are those relationships? And one of the things I would hope that we could be able to do with respect to the philosophers in the room or on the phone is to replace some of the philosophical claims and conjectures and debates with some well-posed logical problems. Next slide, slide 3, relationships of ontology. So the idea is, if we can, one of the ideas for describing a relationship is this, I guess, relationship of generalized, I suppose in the past couple of days in the email, I've been using the word assumption for it. But the idea is, if you have a bunch of theories together in some ontologies, and we want to characterize these relationships, it's more than just saying one ontology is an extension of another in terms of adding more axioms. That will work if the ontologies have the same language. But when you have two ontologies that have different languages, in other words, different sets of primitives, different relations, different functions on those terms,